precious bodily fluids. Remember that? Some of you get a chuckle out of that. But you know what? Stephen Schwartz is making all kinds of sense here. Water, it makes up the majority of what's in all of our bodies, right? Water, we are water. And so if consciousness has an effect on water, then consciousness could have an effect on the water in our bodies. Therefore, what healers do, as he points out, may not be as we have traditionally imagined. In other words, not the healer somehow projecting into our body and creating some sort of change, but rather in cooperation with the healer. Oh, I'm never going to get it right. I know what I'm trying to say. The words just aren't making sense. But Stephen will. He'll be right back. Stephen Schwartz is obviously very excited about this, and I can see why. Muriel in Alvin, Texas asks, I think, a relevant question, Stephen. She says, well, I'd like to know what difference, if any, there was between the 5-minute, 10-minute, and 15-minute vials of water during the experiment.
That's an excellent question, Muriel. I ask exactly the same question. That's why there was a 5, 10, and 15-minute bottle. And the reason I ask that question is healers tell you that they heal all the time, that it's like a kind of constant flow. So presumably, the 15-minute bottle should have shown greater change than the 5-minute bottle. And in fact, that was not what happened. The 5-minute, the 10-minute, and the 15-minute bottle showed the same change, which suggests to us that healing is a pulsed, healing intention is a pulsed phenomena. That is, it's like everything else in your body. There's a buildup, a release, a relaxation, a buildup, a release, a relaxation, that same process. And to my surprise, the healers, although they think about that they're healing all the time, in fact, whatever this was, this linkage that occurred, it occurred in less than 5 minutes. But she's asked a very good question.
All right. Jim in Texas says, I disagree with your guest for the reason that every time I do a healing, if I don't do a cleansing for myself afterward, I get very ill.
Okay. As I said earlier in the show, Art, there are many traditions that give us permission to open to this part of ourselves. And if you believe that something has to be done in a certain way, then that's the way you have to do it, because that's the construct that you have established. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that people will tell you that you can't do, for instance, remote viewing when negative people are around, or you can't do remote viewing when people are physically stressed. And I watched Hella Hammond, one of the great remote viewers, remote viewing a ship that was under the sea that we were trying to locate. I watched her do a remote viewing in the middle of the remote viewing because the sea was very rough. She leaned over the side of the ship, threw up, and then went right back to remote viewing. I watched George McMullen do remote viewing in 114-degree heat in the middle of the Egyptian desert. So the reality that I think is going on is that we set the conditions under which our capacity to open to this aspect of ourselves will function. And when we meet those conditions, then it works. When we don't meet those conditions, it doesn't work. And there are two ways you develop this. You either develop a technique of focus, and it can be a martial art, it can be meditation. That's probably the most significant one, because it teaches a kind of focusing technique. It can be religious.
All right, let me stop you right there.
Sure.
Religious. Water in religion, holy water, baptismal water. In other words, a priest, for example,
yes,
will create intent in with respect to water.
Mm-hmm.
And for as long as we've been alive and a lot longer, that's been going on. So obviously there is a religious,
yes,
connection, a religious
that's right
part of faith that believes in the power of water and the intent that can change that water into something very meaningful.
Absolutely. Water has been associated with healing and with religious ceremony for longer than their writing existed. I mean, it dates back to the very, very earliest days of humanity. And the reason it does, I believe, is that these people were, they did not have technology, and so they developed very acute powers of observation. And they observed that year after year, if you did a certain thing, that it got a certain result, and it was passed on as part of the tradition, the oral tradition, from priest to acolyte or from father to son or whatever it was in that particular culture. And the reason that the I think that water becomes associated with all these ceremonies is that water has this particular ability to be altered by conscious intention. I mean, if you look at, for instance, on the 2nd to the 5th of November, I'm doing a conference on water, and I've brought together healers and scientists, people involved with water from all over the world, because it is becoming clear that whether you're talking about homeopathy, in which water is altered, Rustam Roy, the father of nanotechnology, who will be speaking at the conference, has been doing research on that, or whether you're talking about the crystallization of water that Emoto, the Japanese researcher, has been doing, which Dean Radin at the Noetics Institute has just replicated for the first time under really proper controls. Dean's going to be there. Or whether you're talking about the flow form technology that developed by Schwenk and Schauberger. David Orbach from the Max Planck Institute is going to be coming over to talk about this. However you speak of it, there are all kinds of ways in which consciousness or the manipulation of the environment of water produces this kind of change that we see in the healing water.
Can I make a suggestion for an experiment?
Sure.
Why not take some water that has been blessed by a priest and compare it to a control water?
I was about to tell you that. Douglas Dean, now dead, a wonderful and inventive researcher, a British chemist, did exactly that. He and I had a discussion about this, and he did exactly that. He used water, he had control bottles, and he had water that had been blessed by priests. Now, what he discovered was some, but not all, of the bottles, in fact, did show precisely the change, the same hydrogen bonding change that we observed in the healing study. And that's exactly what you would expect. Some priests hold a much clearer intention. They have a different beingness than other people. And because of their intense focus on their perception of non-local consciousness, and when those kinds of men blessed the water showed change. When people who took it as a sort of meaningless ritual that the church just did it, the water didn't change.
God, that's incredible. That's really incredible. Where do you take the research from here, Stephen?
Well, the next thing that I'm going to be looking at is to really begin to explore this question of how the water in the body changes. Whether this, I'm trying to figure out experimentally how to be able to do this. The difficulty that I've got, or that anybody would have doing an experiment like this, is that the act of taking the measurement, for instance, if we were going to draw blood from people.
I was just going to go there. Why not? Blood
well,
is full of what?
The question is, I don't know the answer to this question, but you've got the right question. The question is, will just the act of taking the blood for the measurement cause a change in the bonding relationship? Because people don't like to get stuck, so they have fear reactions.
That's
and you
true.
See, that might change. So I'm trying to figure out how one might do this. That's the hard part. I think we now have the right question, though. That's the, you know, the as we said earlier, the The problem isn't the answers. It's asking the right questions. It takes a long time to figure out in science how to ask the right question, because you know what you think you're asking, but that's not necessarily what you're really asking. And
yeah, right.
So I'm going to look at that and see whether we can really pin down how therapeutic intent gets into the body. And the other thing I'm interested in looking at, and I'm just now reading the research literature, is this question of, is the healer doing something to you directly, or is there a linkage between your consciousness and the consciousness of the recipient of the therapeutic intent that stimulates their own psychophysical self-regulation response, the same thing that produces the placebo effect?
It would be the latter, I would suspect.
I think it is too, but I can't tell you that experimentally.
So then it really does get difficult to proceed to actually nail this down, and I think it can be nailed down. I'm just not sure experimentally how.
Oh, it's hard. I mean, it's, you know, first of all, it's hard to get the money. It's hard to ask the right questions. It's hard to get the people. This is very tough research. I mean, I will tell you, the hardest part for me, Art, is, you know, I wrote this book, Opening to the Infinite, and when I got through with it, I realized I had to rewrite. I mean, I wrote it many times, but I had to rewrite the entire book, because when I read it after I'd let it sit for a little while, I realized it was totally mired in time-space language. Hmm. I mean, the problem we've got with this is very much like the problem that the people in pre-technological societies had. The only way they could think about non-local consciousness was in spiritual religious terms.
Sure.
Because they just literally did not have the language to ask the question. We're in very much the same place. We have a language which is fixed in time-space. I mean, if you think about the way we talk, it's here, it's there, it's now, it's then. How do you talk about something that doesn't have a time reference and doesn't have a space reference? We know, for instance, in remote viewing, that it is as easy to see something that is close up as it is far away. Mm-hmm. We know that it's as easy to describe a buried archaeological site as it is to describe a canister that you went out and buried in your backyard today. Mm-hmm. So we know that this aspect of consciousness from experimental data does not operate in the time-space constraints that we normally associate. We know that there are, for instance, healing studies, a study I particularly like that was published in the British Medical Journal by a man who was a skeptic and who actually set out to disprove the reality of healing. And he had people prayed for after they got out of the hospital. And he then went and looked at the records of the people compared to a demographically matched group. And he discovered that those people who were the recipient of prayer, now remember, the prayer is 6 months after they're out of the hospital. Right. Those people had less complications, fewer need for drugs, the kind of outcome studies, than the people who were the controls. That means that people were reaching back from the future into the past when it was the present. Not to change it. You can't change the past. But what you can do, based on experimental evidence, is that you can make it come out a certain way in the first instant. And if that's hard to get your head around, it took me 3 days just to figure out how to say that sentence.
Well, and my God, how do you write a book? As you point out,
it's very hard.
You wrote it, and then you had to rewrite it. But when you rewrote it, is it going to be easily digested by people, by neophytes?
Yes, I had to write a book that, and I gave it to people to read, that an ordinary person with a high school education could read. That was my goal. I wanted something that people could read. I write a lot of technical papers. I speak to the scientific community. I wanted to be able to speak to ordinary people who didn't have technical backgrounds, because I think this subject is so important. I mean, what it's telling us is our consciousness is affecting all the aspects of our reality.
Right. Henry has a very good question from Hawaii. He says, why not do this to the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans? Does the amount of water matter?
No, the amount, well, I mean, you need to have about an eyedropper full of water. That's all.
So it does matter.
Well, I mean,
or it doesn't matter.
In
other words, could you produce the kind of molecular changes you're talking about in an ocean?
Ah, well, that's a very interesting question. If you've got 10,000 people to focus on a particular body of water, could you, in fact, change the water? I don't have an answer to that. I'd love to do the experiment.
Well,
I think I'd start with a pond. I don't know.
Our oceans right now are in big trouble. We've got about 200 dead zones around the world right now in the world's oceans, and of course they affect everything. Water is life, and if our oceans are in trouble, we're in trouble. And so it's a relevant question.
It's a very relevant question. And by the way, the thing that's really going to kill us is that the oceans are becoming more acidic as a result of the absorption of the water, of the carbon that's in the atmosphere, which is making the water more acidic, the ocean water more acidic, at the same time as the temperature of the water is rising as a result of global warming.
Mm-hmm.
And those two things are a real double whammy, which are now killing all of the coral reefs around the world. And if you think about that for a second, you realize that if the coral reefs go, the whole ecosystem goes. In the Permian, about 250 million years ago, apparently these exact same circumstances killed off 95% of the life in the ocean. So, yes, this is a very serious problem. You want to talk about conspiracies. The water crisis that is coming down the line like a roaring train, nobody talks about. It's just
no, amazing. They don't. We take water for granted, Stephen. We turn on the tap in America,
exactly.
And you can be sure you're going to get nice, clean water. That's not necessarily the truth where I am, by the way. But in America,
that's a synchronicity, Art. I just wrote a column for Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing. I write a regular column for them, and my first sentence was almost exactly word for word what you just said.
Really?
Yes. That's a very interesting little synchronicity right in and of itself. Yeah, that was what struck me.
It is. So, again, it seems to me that there's a wide open field for where your research, where your experimentation could go from here. What a wide field.
Yes, and it's going in a lot of different directions. For instance, David Orbach and Jennifer Green, who are going to speak at this conference on the 2nd to the 5th of November, they have been working with these vortices that were originally described by a man named Victor Schauberger and another man named Schwenk, who was an anthroposophist, a follower of Rudolf Steiner. And they have shown that when you move water through a what's called a flow form, a kind of fountain arrangement in which it produces these vortices, these little sort of like when the toilet flushes, you know, and it forms that circle going down, that's a kind of vortice.
Yes.
That when you produce vortices which match the natural arrangement of water, that it occurs in the natural state when it's flowing in streams, that water produces, for instance, increased growth in plants. It seems to be more healthful. One of the experiments that I did, and I want to do again, is I had a flow form, a kind of this structure where the water flows down, and I put it in a greenhouse, which I split in two, and on one half of the greenhouse I had the flow form, which is like a big slanted thing where the water ran down, and on the other side I just put a gutter at the same slant level, and I took seeds that I broke randomly into two pots and two groups, planted them in the greenhouse. The greenhouse had a plastic wall between the two halves, and I measured the growth of the seeds that were watered by the water of the flow form compared to the water that just went down the gutter. And they were 27% larger. The flow form plants were 27% larger than the regular plants, the control plants.
You really, really are on to something. All right, Stephen, hold tight. We're at the bottom of the hour. I'm Art Bell from the other side of the world, Manila, in the Philippines. This is Coast to Coast AM. Boy, it is coast to coast, and I'm talking about even the coast separated by oceans. Howdy, everybody. Stephen Schwartz is my guest. We're talking about the world of water, and while on the face of it, that might sound a little boring, water, not at all, not this conversation. What a question I've got from George in Rochester, New York, who says, hey, Art, ask Stephen, we have this evidence that transplanted organs carry memories from the donor to the recipient, and we sure do, don't we? I wonder if this could be memory carried by the moisture, in other words, the water in the organs. We'll ask Stephen about that in a moment. Once again, Stephen Schwartz. Stephen, welcome back. That question is very interesting. Memories carried from the donor to the recipient.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I'd actually never thought about that. But if I were asked to bet, I would bet that indeed it was the water, the fluid inside the cells.
Indeed.
That is carrying this intention. I mean, I'm aware of the literature about people who get hearts and various things, who develop tastes that they never had before, suddenly have cravings for foods they never ate before, that kind of thing.
Or even know the name of their donors.
Yes, there's a lot of stuff. I think that the water may, in fact, be the linkage point. I don't know that. I mean, I can't say that from any experimental evidence. That's a wonderful question. By the way, you've gotten great questions tonight. The guy from Hawaii about changing the ocean. That really was a very interesting. And this
one, by the way, while we're on the subject of the ocean, pretty much if you take a look, the North Pole is melting.
Literally,
the North Pole is melting. It's changing the salinity of the water near it.
Absolutely.
And, if water is such a big factor as we think it is. I'm sorry, if water is as big a factor as we think it is, then surely ice at the north entire part of the world changing into water is going to be significant.
It's going to be a huge effect. It's causing a change in the pH of the water. It's going to raise the water. It's going to dilute. Part of the result of diluting the salinity of the water is the breakdown of the world ocean current that carries, for instance, warm water up along France and England and Scotland.
That's right.
And they may experience in this era of coming global warming, they may get warmer, and then if this current breaks down, they will suddenly get much colder. The breaking up of the Larsen B ice shelf, for instance, which occurred in 2002, was a chunk of ice as big as Rhode Island.
I know. They thought it would go very slowly. It went all at once.
It is going up, by some estimates, as much as five times as fast as was originally predicted.
Mm-hmm.
This is a huge crisis that is coming down the track toward us.
All right. Well, that brings up politics then. You think that water even affects politics, history itself?
Oh, I think water is destiny. I think in this century, water is going to be far more important than petroleum. For instance, I'll give you an example. Right now, approximately one in three, one-third of the people in the world have some measure of water scarcity. When the glaciers that are in the Himalayas melt, as they are doing, 2.5 billion people will be thrown into water crisis. To give you a more American example, the Glacier National Park in Kalispell, Montana, which is famous for its glaciers and the beautiful lakes and meadows and all that, there will be no glaciers, it is now predicted, by 2030. So if you plan to take your kids out to see a glacier in the United States, you better do it pretty quick, because it ain't going to be there much longer.
That's right. I remember an advertiser that I had years ago, Stephen, and it was very, very interesting. It was a sort of a clamped-on, very, very powerful magnet. And what you did, you clamped these magnets on the input water to your home, wherever your water came from, whether it was a city or a well or whatever. And it would change in some way as the water flowed past the magnetic field. It would change the water molecules in a way that I can't articulate right now and I can't recall. But it did have a big effect on the water. All of a sudden, your water spigots and so forth and so on wouldn't have this collection of white, I guess, salt or whatever it is. It would dissolve into the water in a way that just flowed out and didn't get stuck on things. It was really strange, but it worked.
Well, there are a number of, see, that's the thing about water. It's so labile. It's so susceptible to change at so many levels, not just chemically, but as we've been saying, from therapeutic intention or just intention in general. That and it's in homeopathic preparations, for instance, all those kinds of things. Water clearly has, maybe because a majority of our body is made up of water, that may be part of it, but water has some capacity to operate with these linkages that we've been describing. And exactly how this works is not clear, but that it does work can be experimentally demonstrated.
You're damn right. Stephen, going back to one of the crazy experiments that I did with my audience years ago, we created rain in areas where there was absolutely no forecast for rain. In fact, there had been drought, unrelenting, horrible drought. And I had my audience for long periods of time, millions of people literally, concentrate on creating moisture, concentrate on trying to create clouds, moisture, clouds, rain. It worked.
Well,
I don't
know
if you
remember Wilhelm Reich.
Do you recall those experiments? Did you hear about them?
I saw cloud busters. I used to know a guy named Trevor Constable that made cloud busters. And do you remember, Art, the guy who was called the Hurricane Man, who threatened baseball teams with rainouts unless they paid him money, and some of the teams did pay him. Do you remember him?
I know baseball teams are very superstitious. I don't recall him, but I can imagine.
Well, he would concentrate on moving hurricanes to land. And years ago, when I met this guy, a guy named Jeff Mishlove wrote a book about him. Documenting some of his stuff. It was really quite, it's called Lightning Man, Storm Man. Anyway, Jeff Mishlove, people can find it.
He wouldn't live long down in Louisiana.
Yeah, and I knew a woman here in Virginia Beach, Eula Allen, who organized groups to pray to send healing to the weather system when he was doing that. And she showed me, at the time, this is one of the things that got me interested in water, a track in which every time this guy said, I'm going to move the storm onshore to Baltimore, I think it was, she would organize people all over the country to focus on it keeping out to sea, and this storm zigged and zagged back, and at the time, newspapers commented on what a crazy path the storm had. So is it possible that people could produce rain, for instance? Well, the Hopis believe so.
The Tibetans
believe so.
Absolutely.
So
coming back, how can water affect politics? That's quite a reach.
Well, no. 2.5 billion people don't have water. What do you think is going to happen? They're going to pour over the borders. I mean, if you look at the current political situation in North Korea, what the Chinese are doing is, they don't, you know, they have a very pragmatic point of view. They don't care if the North Korean regime is despotic and treats its people terribly. What they don't want is millions of North Koreans streaming across their border to press them. What do you think is going to happen, for instance, in Gaza, which is sucking out the groundwater, you know, the deep fossil water that does not get replaced? They're pumping it out at about twice the rate that they ought to be, and when that water is gone, where do you think those people are going to go? The wars are going to be fought over water. Look at what's going on in the southwestern United States with the droughts that are going on. These droughts produce dry forests, which create more wildfires. Look at the Colorado River, for instance. The fights that are going on over who's going to get the water.
That's
which,
true.
Which group of special interests are going to be able to get access to that? Water is destiny.
It's true. So there's the answer to the question. It certainly is political, and eventually it's going to be water wars. That's been predicted for a number of years, that there would be wars about water.
Oh,
I
think,
see it happening.
Let me give you another one. It takes 1,000 tons of water to grow a ton of grain. So when grain moves around the world, what's really moving around the world is water. And when that water is not available to grow that grain, what's going to happen? There are huge, huge problems that are coming along. As the ice melts, the current predictions are that if the ice sheets completely melt, that the sea will rise 21 feet.
Mm-hmm.
They are now talking that by the end of this century, it will rise 3 feet. Now, that doesn't sound like very much, but if you look, if you hold your feet, you hold your hand 3 feet off the ground, and you imagine that the water is now that deep, and you see a plane going out in all directions, you will be astonished at how much of it covers. I mean, I live in Virginia Beach, and I live on the water, and if the water came up 3 feet, my living room would be a swimming pool.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's...
You live in Manila, for instance.
That's
the Philippines
right.
are going to be devastated by the rise in seawater.
No question about it. I can see the water from my window, and 3 feet would probably put it at the base of my building.
Yes, you'd be doing the show in a bathing suit.
All of this is absolutely incredible. What would you imagine... The rise in sea level, the rise in water in the world as the melting continues would produce, other than the displacement, obviously, of people, as we just talked about at the coast, that much more water and the change of the pH and the change in the salinity of the water, I wonder what that would bring with it.
Well, it's going to bring with it. I mean, I'll give you one that really got my attention. In Canada, as a result of global warming and the melting of the sea ice, and the Inuit, what they call First Americans, they have just recently lowered the price of electricity in the northern provinces because the Eskimos are all having to buy air conditioners. Because, you know, it's like selling an icebox to an Eskimo,
yeah.
They're buying them.
Air conditioners. That one I hadn't heard. I had heard that polar bears are beginning to drown because they have no ice to get onto. I've heard the Inuits are beginning to move because they recognize that what was their land is going to be or is now beginning to go underwater, and they're not going to be able to stay there any longer.
There are robins flying in the spring in the Arctic. They're growing broccoli and Chinese cabbage and cauliflower in Greenland. They've just planted the first olive groves in southern England. Olive groves in Devonshire.
Hmm. Well, all right. What you're doing is incredibly important. The experiments you're doing are important. Getting it documented, getting it, moving it into the mainstream scientific community is really important. And how do we do that?
Well, you know, I'm holding a conference because I want people, there's nothing that people can get a handle on about the whole picture of this. You know, when you read about it, first of all, you hardly hear anything. We're so enraptured by Madonna's adoption that almost nothing else can get into the popular media. I mean, if it weren't for interviews like this one, I don't know who would be talking about it. So, I mean, I appreciate the opportunity to get a chance to talk about this. There is so little coverage that part of it is just getting people to realize that water is not the birthright you thought it was, something you turn on the tap and it always comes out, that it is, in fact, one of the most important issues that we are going to face and that our children are going to face. Imagine what this world is going to look like for our children at the end of this century, with water up 3 feet, with the coral reefs dead, the food stock, the fishing stocks destroyed because the ecosystems have collapsed. I mean, this gets very apocalyptic, and that's the conservative view.
Hey, it really is. We've had the impression that we could take our waste products, our factories' waste products, and our human waste products, and simply dump them in the water, and all would be fine. It would simply sort of disperse, and there would not be an effect. Well, 200 dead spots in the ocean are beginning to tell us that might not be so.
Oh, let me give you another one. We are dumping pharmaceuticals that come out of the waste product of chicken and pig farms and that are put onto crops that are washing down into the water and are producing androgynous fish and muscles that don't look like anything anybody has ever seen before.
Mm-hmm.
The pollutants that we just don't even think about, we just put them in the water, are having an effect on the entire ecosystem. We have got to wake up to this. I mean, we need to stop being worried about, did the government put explosives in the World Trade Towers, and instead start focusing on what the hell's coming out of the water on my tap, and what's going to happen to my kids when they try to go down to the beach, and where am I going to get healthful food and have sufficient water to be able to just survive.
They're also noticing, by the way, Stephen. Yeah, they're also beginning to notice, Stephen, that fish are changing sex.
Yes.
Mysteriously, and for some unknown reason, there's a feminization going on of the fish. It's weird.
That's right. It's very, very serious stuff. And so I have changed my focus from other research. I mean, I'm still continuing the remote viewing research and will continue that because I find it very useful. You know, once I did a show with you about 5 years ago, I guess it was, on the 2050 project,
mm-hmm.
getting people to remote view 2050. And much of what they told me, and I don't want to say too much about it because people actually do this experiment and they might be listening and that would cue them, but I can tell you that the 2050s all are concerned about water. It's just that the hard part for Americans is we have so long had decent water systems compared to most of the rest of the world that we just really don't think about it. You know, you go down to the beach at the ocean and you turn on your tap or you turn on your laundry machine or whatever, and everything just kind of works.
Well, I can tell you, living here in the Philippines, I live in a building where we have a processing plant for water. But other than specifically where I live, my friend, what you see walking around the streets are Filipinos with bottled water everywhere in their hands because the water is marginally not drinkable.
Right. Well, that's true of most of the world.
Yes, it is.
And when the Himalayan glaciers melt, and 2.5 billion people suddenly don't have good drinking water, or when the water is not available in parts of the Middle East, we're going to have wars and huge population movements.
Yeah,
we
I wonder how long it's going to be in the,
now.
How long in the Middle East before this reaches crisis proportion? Not very long, I think.
No, it's not very long at all. I mean, that's part of the problem with this is that. Because we haven't really been paying much attention, it's coming up on us. I mean, we're talking in the 20 to 30-year range. So enough time that we might be able to do something, but not so much time that we can afford to have any indulgences about this.
All right, Stephen. I've held you now for a couple of hours to myself. What I'm going to do is open the phone lines when we get back, and I know a lot of you are electrified by this because I certainly am. Stephen Schwartz is my guest. We're discussing water and human intent on water. He described experiments at the beginning of the program, first hour of the program, that without any shadow of a doubt prove human intent on water has a gigantic effect. I'm Art Bell.